Direct from the Broski Nation headquarters in Los Angeles, California, this is the Broski Report with your host, Brittany Broski.
Yeah, I'm fried. I'm fried. I'm fucked up. Guys, sit down. Shh. All right, take your seats. I'm fried. I'm fucked up. Today, I have a very special gift for you guys. Welcome back to the Broski Report, starring me, your host, Brittany Broski. Special gift for you guys in today's class, okay? We've got a live special guest performer. Please welcome Future. Yeah, I'm fried. I'm fucked up. That's a type of mood type shit. Hey. Okay. Cause I'm heartless and I'm back in movies and I'm heartless. Hey guys, I am 3 Red Bulls deep. Okay. It's 11 p.m. Whatever. There is so much to talk about at all times. And just like, I feel like no one takes me seriously. And I cannot imagine why, because I've never joked once. I've never come on here and tried to like act funny. Everything I say is genuine and earnest. And it hurts my feelings when someone's like, I can't take you seriously because have you never seen a multifaceted woman? Would you look Sylvia Plath in the eye and tell her to not be depressed? Hey guys, welcome back to the Broski Report. Today we're getting to the bottom of who the fuck is Wendy and why does she make burgers? Why did Wendy come up with the 4 for 4 and where did it go? Okay, welcome back to, what was Chris Hansen's show called? How old is Chris Hansen? 64? Damn. Chris Hansen is an American television presenter, journalist, and YouTube personality. He rose to mainstream recognition as a correspondent for Dateline NBC and the host for its short-lived segment To Catch a Predator, which revolved around catching potential internet predators using a sting operation. Now, that would make sense that he's moved on to YouTube. There's a lot of predators on YouTube, Minecraft specifically. Okay, what was I going to look up? I was going to look up, what is the backstory of Wendy's hamburgers? Dave Thomas, the founder of Wendy's. Okay, so it's not even Wendy herself. Once again, men using women as a marketing ploy. He is exploiting a little ginger child like they don't have it hard enough. Oh my God, what a creep. Dave Thomas, the founder of Wendy's, opened the first Wendy's in Columbus, Ohio in 1969. Now, arguably, probably the only good thing to come out of Columbus, Ohio in the last, what's that, give or take, 54 years. Thomas was inspired to start Wendy's after being unable to find a good hamburger in Columbus. There's nothing better to complain about during literal wartime. 1969. Prime Vietnam War sort of era. Than being like, damn, you know, we can't really get a good burger out here. We should start up a joint, shouldn't we? Yeah, we should. Meh. He believed in serving fresh food made by nice people. And his first Wendy's had an upscale feel with carpeting. Tiffany lamps, hanging beads, and bentwood chairs. Why did we do away with that? The workers wore white aprons with men in white pants, white shirts, and black bow ties, and women in white dresses and scarves. Now that is crazy. His boyhood dream of opening a burger restaurant was coming true. After trying all 5 of his children's names for the restaurant, Dave decided on his daughter Melinda's nickname, Wendy. What? If someone named me Melinda and they were like, we're just kidding, we're going to call you Wendy, I would be like, there is a bomb planted somewhere under this house. The last person to find it? Well, we know how that goes. Dave's legacy. Who the fuck is Dave, dude? That's about to piss me off. Oh, this nickname stemmed from the fact that her siblings couldn't pronounce her name. So they started calling her Winda, which then turned into Wendy. Kind of like a smiley Miley Cyrus sort of thing, okay? Destiny Hope Cyrus. Isn't that crazy? Her government name is Destiny. Smiley Miley, okay? He felt, okay, here we go. He felt that the logo of a smiling, wholesome little girl with the name Wendy's Old Fashioned Hamburgers would be the place where you went for a hamburger the way you used to get them, with fresh beef. Nothing says fresh, ground-fed beef like a little six-year-old ginger girl. The first menu included hot and juicy hamburgers, rich and meaty chili, French fries, soft drinks, and a frosty dairy dessert. Indiscriminate, I guess. Undisclosed, indiscriminate, frosty dairy dessert. From the beginning, Dave wanted Wendy's to be a place to get great food, made fresh and served by friendly people, a place that didn't cut corners on quality. And now they serve you horse meat chicken nuggets in a Ziploc bag. With a hamburger the size of your fist. Wendy's became known for square ground beef hamburgers that hang over the bun, made with the customer's choice of toppings. How the mighty have fallen. That looks like a damn good hamburger, dude. How the mighty have fucking fallen. Let's pull up a normal Wendy's burger. That is not what Wendy's hamburgers look like, dude. They always, oh, the Baconator. No, the Baconator is, yep, here we go. Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. Wendy's loaded. Wendy's loaded nacho cheeseburger. The impulse of mind. You know what this looks like? The fucking... It looks like the burger that killed the health inspector on that episode of SpongeBob. The burger is called the Nasty Patty. It contained the following ingredients: regular Krabby Patty ingredients, volcano sauce, seahorse radish, toenail clippings, dropped into the toilet, dried with old gym socks, miscellaneous revolting items. Oh my God! Dropped into the toilet, dried with old gym socks. Okay. You want to know something about me? I'd eat it. I eat it. Okay? Looks kind of crunchy. Tell me that there is not some form of aesthetic similarity between the Wendy's loaded nacho volcanic diarrhea cheeseburger and the Nasty Patty. Please show me the difference. Oh my God, that is fucking repulsive, dude. Give me three vodka shots, though, and I am bodying that like you have like I'm in one of those burger eating competitions, dude. You have never seen someone's jaw unhinge in a way, like a human serpent. Have y'all ever seen a snake really actually eat a mouse? Let's pull up handy dandy YouTube. Snake eating mouse. Their jaw unhinges. Freaking redneck. Welcome back, guys. We're going to be feeding my little snake a garter mouse. We're going to be feeding my garter snake a little mouse. Come on, skip to the action. Don't edge me. Oh my God, snakes are so scary. Oh my God, ew, that's going to send a chill down my spine. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored by Shopify. Quickly, what is the easiest choice you can make? window instead of middle seat, picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket. What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading e-commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow or are growing, Shopify gives you everything you need at every level to take control and take your business to that next stage. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/broski, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/broski now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/broski.
Welcome back. So I don't know why that was actually like exhibit A of intrusive thought winning. I don't know why I've had the literally a compulsion to YouTube search snake swallowing mouse hole, and then I did it and then I didn't like it. But is it a crime to be repulsed by nature? Am I so far removed from my primal chimpanzee ancestors that truly sent a chill down my spine? That really actually disturbed and repulsed me. That is just nature, baby. What are snakes supposed to eat? What are snakes supposed to eat? A Wendy's loaded nacho cheeseburger? No. That shit's too big. They couldn't unhinge their jaw. Leave that to the big boys like me. Leave that to the real fucking Olympians. Jaw monster. I unhinge my jaw and it expands and comes down. You know, like when you would see like old Vikings or whatever, they would wear tiger heads, like, or they would like skin a bear and like wear that, the revenant. But that's me. That's okay. The cheeseburger, Wendy skinned me, and Wendy's wearing my skin like a battle relic, like a reward. Okay. Cause Wendy. Actually, when you choose to eat at any of these disgusting fast food restaurants, look at this shit. What is that, dude? It's got pre-cum on it. It's freaking jizzing everywhere, bro. It freaking jizzed out of the freaking square thing. Okay, cows aren't square. Why the fuck would it be square on the burger, bro? Ew. Okay, did anyone say, well, see, Wendy's and it jizzed on their mouths, all up in their mouths and on their tongues? You guys gave me the gay burger. You guys gave me the gay freaking cheeseburger, jizz burger, Wendy's loaded jizz cum burger. Oh, my sciatica just flared up. Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh yeah, Wendy's gonna skin me like a sort of barbaric Viking reward for besting me. And that's honestly on me that I chose to go to Wendy's and be like, one hamburger, please. And they serve me the nasty patty and I fucking eat it. That's on me at a certain point, okay? Guys, can I level with you really quick? I'm having what I might call an episode. My man was supposed to come visit me this weekend. Didn't, okay? Having somewhat of an episode. I will not be taking questions at this time. I am feeling like, skip it about a booby, skip it about a booby. The little kid from Wild Thornberries, which Nigel Wood. Wild Thornberries. This show was crazy. Wild Thornberries. They were like, yeah, we're going to make a sexy one. And then a little fucking nerd. Here's the sexy one. God, she was so period. And then here's the fucking nerd. Nigel Thornberry. I think deep inside of me is a Nigel Thornberry. Okay, back to Wendy. I want to know more about the lore. Let's go back to the lore. The Wendy's, I want to see Wendy's original interior. Oh, wow, y'all. That is just gorgeous. Oh, wow, look, there's greenery. Oh, that is just darling. This is something that I could genuinely, like, to be earnest for a second, I could bitch about it for hours on end. The loss of personality, style, detail, and design as we move towards the digital age. We're in the digital age. As it progresses and as things become more clinical, as they become more technologically inclined, we lose the glass, the art of glass blowing, stained glass, wooden etchings and carvings, a nice wallpaper. All these things inherently are human in nature of we want a space decorated with beautiful, ostentatious things. Superfluous design that is there because we want it there. Fuck these houses that are all modern. Everything's white. There's no personality. There's no character to any of these, like, and it just looks so medical. I mean, it looks like a hospital from the future, but people live there. I remember people were gagged when Kim Kardashian showed her house. Like, you're raising children in this house? That's crazy. Oh my God, take me back to this Wendy's. Look at this. Tiffany lamps in the Wendy's. Take me back, God. With the little beads. We're losing our pizzazz, people. We need to make 2024. We need to make 2025 the year of pizzazz. This is for my East Coasters. Do y'all know about this place? Friendly's? Friendly's Family Restaurant and Ice Cream. Friendly's Interior, Maryland. Ugh, am I not thinking of Friendly's? Friendly's Restaurant. Yeah. Yes. This is Friendly's. This is a place on the East Coast. I remember it being having a lot more character as a child. It's just like a classic diner. And they, oh my God, they have the best desserts. But now that I'm older and I'm not like motivated by high fructose corn syrup, and let me qualify that with saying I still am. I just, my doctor now scolds me. And I get charged thousands of dollars when I eat too much high fructose corn syrup. Okay, so the repercussions, the stakes are a little higher as a 26-year-old going on 27, okay? As a child, high fructose corn syrup is similar to the nectar of life. As an American child, waking up and just necking. Do you remember the vacuum from Teletubbies? Say one more time. Like, can you speak? Speak normal. Speak like an educated adult. When you, can I, like, when you, vacuum sucker from Teletubbies. This guy. Now, this is what I turn into. And my eyes kind of look like that. This is what I turn into when you put a high fructose corn syrup or any form of Red 40 dyed snack in front of me. I'm talking Lucky Charms. You know what I loved as a kid? Honeycombs. Do you remember honeycomb syrup? I literally would turn into the vacuum from Teletubbies and just, I could eat a whole box of honeycombs by myself in under 20 minutes. I love honeycombs. They just did it for me for some reason. I wasn't like the rest of you bitches. I didn't need the fake marshmallows and the tricks with all the colors and all the whatever. Give me a box of honeycombs. Give me Liberty or give me death. You know what? I also loved Raisin Bran because my dad loved Raisin Bran. And when you eat it enough, it starts to become sugary because everything in America has, you guessed it, added sugar. added sugar. Even what's that skinny Almond Mom one? Special K. How much sugar is in Special K cereal with strawberries? 11 grams of sugar, 21 grams of sugar with 3/4 cup skim milk. Okay, 21 grams of sugar with milk. How much sugar is in Lucky Charms? 1 cup serving of Lucky Charms contains 15.5 grams of sugar. A 3/4 cup serving contains 10 grams of sugar. Okay, I don't know if we're comparing apples to apples, though. How much sugar is in... What's another one? Cocoa Puffs. Cocoa Puffs. 10 grams. See what I'm saying? The fucking Special K had more sugar in it, and that was marketed as the skinny one. Unless I'm tweaking. How much sugar is in Special K? Special K with strawberries. Because that's the one, let's be totally for real. That's what everyone would eat. Yeah, dude, it says 11 grams. It's up there. Like, there are so many things that we're marketed to, especially as women, we're marketed to with, like, pink packaging and the fucking pink washing with the breast cancer awareness. And you think that you're making a difference when you're buying these foods and these processed items, and you're not. It is poison. You're putting poison in your body. Okay? But would I eat honeycombs at the drop of a hat? Yes, I would, because they're delicious. They're delicious. I can't have milk or sugar on this fucking, it's not even a diet. It's like a, they, stupid. I'm giggling at a, someone edited the Teletubby suck machine on a browser's thing. It's dumb. I have the sense of humor of an 8-year-old boy. What was I talking about? Oh yeah, being a woman. I resent diet culture because diet culture is not pushed on young men the same way it's pushed on young women. I started to become aware of it, like truly sentient in college. When you start truly thinking about the ways in which products are marketed to you so that you as an empathetic individual will spend your money on an object or an item or a food item, I started to be a more cognizant and informed buyer in college. But then, you know, you live in this idealistic mindset, this idealistic world that you can be a conscientious shopper. And that is not always the truth. When you are poor, when you live in a food desert, when you have any of XYZ factors contributing to you would like to shop sustainably, you would like to eat sustainably, but you cannot afford to. That is the reality for a lot of Americans. That's what I was met with post-college. You know, you take all these classes about greenwashing and cancer research and companies like Patagonia, where, you know, they're doing great things and you should support this company. Or, you know, you start learning about sustainability reports and corporate social responsibility, corporate social, it's a CSR report. CSR report. Corporate social responsibility reporting. Yes. The practice where businesses disclose information about their environmental, social, and governance activities. There are consulting companies. That's what a lot of people in my major comm went on to do, is CSR reporting or consulting for a lot of these major companies, you know, where they have to hit a threshold of like, we're not emitting this much whatever into the atmosphere, and we have to report that. And then all the shit about like carbon offsets and all, it's a whole world that I won't even talk about. But when it comes to companies like, and these are notable from the classes I took, Ben and Jerry's and Patagonia, those are the two that come to mind because we studied them as case studies of, here are companies that are willing to accept profit loss for the sake of social responsibility. Being a high-earning company, being a company that feels more of a moral responsibility to their purchasers and their investors and their stakeholders, than, you know, profit. And that is so incredibly rare. And I'm not saying that, you know, the two companies I just mentioned are worthy of like worship and, you know, only buy from these brands. No one is innocent. Every company is evil. It's just a matter of, you know, lesser of evils in the game of capitalism. So I think that taking that class for me really opened my eyes to it starts with an individual at a company being like, I refuse to be a part of this statistic. Regardless, you will be. It's just a matter of minimizing damage. Patagonia recently like sold Patagonia CSR. Here we go. In June 2023, Patagonia became the most recognized corporate leader by sustainability professionals in the GlobeScan/sustainability survey, overtaking Unilever, which had held the top spot for over a decade. Unilever held the top spot. Patagonia doesn't own any of the apparel assembly factories that make its products, so it has limited control over how much workers receive. Patagonia's CSR efforts include fair trade. Patagonia uses fair trade to improve workers' wages and provide them with benefits that improve their lives. These are all just such general statements. Partnering with grassroots organizations, Patagonia partners with grassroots organizations and frontline communities to restore the health of lands, air, and waters. Patagonia funds work that addresses the root cause of the environmental crisis and seeks to protect the environment and affected communities. You know, these are all like, you want to believe these things. You want to believe that lending your money to these sort of companies in exchange for a product, and Patagonia is not cheap, that money is working towards a better world. Fair wages for the people that made the product, sustainable methods of creating said products, because Patagonia is a clothing company, and clothing, specifically fast fashion, is one of the largest contributors to climate change and how rapidly climate change is accelerating. So all that considered, you know, I guess it's this question of, is it a net positive? Or are we just praising some of these companies for not being inherently evil? I don't know. We learned about all this and it was just so jaw-dropping to me, because I don't know, I think there comes a time where you're like, I'm going to start to look at the world more critically. And that's what, you know, around college, around late high school is when you start to think about, oh my God, I'm going to be voting in my first election. You know, I'm going to be taken seriously as an adult. I'm no longer just a student, or I'm no longer just a kid. It's like, I could be conscripted. I could be enlisted in the military. Can't drink alcohol, but I can fight for my country. Love that. And there, a switch happens. That's why I'm such an advocate for higher education. And I know that it's not accessible to everyone in this country. And I know it's an inherently flawed system. All that goes without saying. But I can still say that there is such value in being at pursuing a degree, being around people in a different environment that isn't your hometown. There's so much to be learned, and there is so much to think about that you never would have been forced to think about. And that is a truth. I've talked about it before, how Europeans are so shocked that Americans, a lot of Americans never, ever leave the country. They never leave the state that they're born in. First of all, because America is so vast and it is so large that, you know, you can experience a lot of different terrains, a lot of different cultures without ever leaving the borders of the United States. But what is to be said about how that limits your understanding of the world and how it works and how we're lied to and how, you know, just how the powers that be maintain and enforce power. You never learn or even have enough care to question authority. And places like college campuses are where those sort of grassroots, you know, it's where those sentiments are the flames are fanned, okay? Anyway, when we studied this in comm, I remember feeling so, and there's an innocence to it, you know, feeling so lied to and feeling so disappointed. And then you feel this overwhelming compulsion or need to, well, I'm only going to shop sustainably. I'm only going to do this. I'm only going to do that. I'm going to reduce my water usage. I'm going to be waste free. I'm going to buy everything organic. I'm going to do this. These things are just not possible for everyone. It is definitely a goal that all of us should be working towards, but the onus lies on the major companies. There is only so much individuals can do. Individuals can start a movement, and that's not to be undervalued, but there's a limit. You know, there's a limit to enacting a certain amount of change. And that was something, because it was a double sort of wave that hit me of, we have fucked this planet. My God, we fucked this planet. And there's no going back, and we're all going to die. Then you get a wave of hope for people like Greta Thunberg and companies maybe like Patagonia or Ben & Jerry's, where Ben & Jerry's more so is like socially, you know, they're incredibly leftist. Not so much doing a lot for sustainability, but they're very leftist and liberal and believe in gay rights. So thanks, Ben & Jerry's. But at the same time, that does not absolve you of the sins of being a major conglomerate, fucking capitalist, pig business, whatever. Okay? Love ice cream. But. So that was, it was coming at me in waves in college, and it was hard. You know, when you start to lose that innocence slowly but surely, everyone has to do it. It's part of life. But it's about where you land after that wave of disappointment and betrayal washes over you, and then a wave of hope washes over you of, I can change this. I will be a part of the change. And then a more neutral wave washes over you of, okay, let's be realistic. And you resign yourself to this idea that, you know, yes, I can be a part of change. I can affect change. But it starts, you know, it's about dismantling the powers that be. It's this sort of impossible uphill climb is what it feels like. And maybe that's me sort of resigning myself to nihilism, or, you know, just am so frustrated by living in this country and feeling powerless. And it's a hopeless feeling. But you cannot give up on hope. Hope is what makes us inherently human. It is a human quality. You cannot crush hope. Okay? It will always find a way.
This episode is sponsored by SeatGeek. You guys have used my code with SeatGeek so much that they wanted to hook you up with a new special offer. So listen up! Use code BROSKI10 for 10% off any tickets on SeatGeek, whether you're a new customer or not. And guys, concert season is back. Artists like Drake, Nicki Minaj, Hozier, and Bad Bunny are all on tour, and you already know that SeatGeek is the best place to get tickets. You also already know that I'm seeing Hozier in July, rightfully so, and surely you know that I'm going to pee down my leg like a small dog. No matter how many times you've bought tickets using SeatGeek before, Broski 10 is going to get you 10% off your next order. So take out your phone, open the SeatGeek app, and add my code BROSKI10 to your account. What are you waiting for? Do it now, because this offer is only available for a limited time. That's code BROSKI10 for 10% off only on SeatGeek.
Okay, so anyway, yeah, if you guys are curious about CSR, Google that shit. Very, very interesting. And it is impossible to be a 100% just informed buyer, in my opinion. You know, there are certain things, and being realistic about budgets and the failing economy and living within your means, that you have to sacrifice, you know, something. Not everyone can afford fucking organic eggs. Not everyone can afford organic herbs. So, moving on. Back to Wendy's. Okay, back to Wendy's. I also want to talk about Popeyes. What is the history of Popeyes? Alvin C. Copeland Sr. founded Popeyes in 1972 in Arabi, Louisiana, and named it Chicken on the Run The restaurant served traditional Southern fried chicken, but initially struggled to attract customers. Copeland changed the name to Popeye's Mighty Good Chicken in 1972, but the Los Angeles Times claims the new name was Popeye's Mighty Good Fried Chicken. Copeland later claimed to name the stores after the fictional detective Jimmy Popeye Doyle in the 1971 film The French Connection through the company's early brand, though the company's early brand became closely tied to the cartoon star. Interesting. Okay, let's look at Detective Jimmy Popeye Doyle, portrayed by Gene Hackman. Doyle is tough, obsessive, and intolerant, and he doesn't always follow the rules. Man, nothing says fried chicken like tough, obsessive, intolerant, and doesn't follow the rules. That's actually so true. Popeye's has had several name changes since then, and as of 2021, it has 3,705 restaurants in more than 46 states and the District of Columbia. The restaurant's menu features spicy chicken, yup, chicken tenders, yup, fried shrimp, yup, and other regional items like rice and beans, red beans and rice. Damn. Which is older, KFC or Popeye's? Okay, when was Popeye's? 1972. I bet KFC's older. Popeye's has been frying chicken since 1972. According to People magazine, the founder, Copeland Sr., opened the eatery to compete with Kentucky Fried Chicken franchises, the first of which opened two decades prior in Utah. Okay, so that's in the 50s. KFC was in the 50s. Now let's talk about the Colonel. Was Colonel Sanders at the Capitol on January 6th? Stupid. Was Colonel Sanders real? Colonel Harlan David Sanders was an American businessman. Holy shit, he was real! And later, he acted as the company's brand ambassador. He founded it. No fucking way. I don't know why I'm acting surprised. I've seen this photo before. Crazy real life story. Let's read it. This man was probably a raging racist. Oh my God, it's just radiating off of him. Colonel Sanders is an American advertising icon whose goateed and bespectacled face is as well known around the world as Ronald McDonald or the Kool-Aid Man. The difference, of course, is that Colonel Sanders was an actual person. It can be easy to forget that he was a real man and not just a cartoon character. His life story is a buck wild roller coaster full of struggles and gunfights and not finding success until Social Security times. What? Harlan Sanders had a hard go of it from a young age, following his birth outside Henryville, Indiana. He's not even from Kentucky. He was born in 1890. He was raised by an ultra-religious mother who taught him that alcohol, tobacco, coffee, and playing cards were all equally poisonous. I know, that's right. After his mother got married to a man who wasn't so keen on the idea of stepchildren, Sanders had to go make his way in the world at 12 years old. Damn. Time to work the mines, boy. You got a tight little body. Let's see how it fits up the chimney. He worked on a farm while going to school, and when that got too hard, he quit school just 2 weeks into seventh grade to start slinging chicken. Over the next 3 decades of his life, he was a streetcar conductor, a railroad fireman, studied law by mail. Now, what does that mean, do you think? Worked as a midwife? What? Operated a steamboat ferry, and even more, mostly failing at all these things. Now that is the realest shit I've ever fucking heard. He did this, and he fucking shocked at all of them. And he was horrible. He got married at age 18 and had 3 children. After Sanders got fired from the railroad, man, how do you get fired from the railroad, brother? You're just laying nails and hitting them into the ground. You are quite literally laying railroad track and you got fired. His wife left and went to her parents in Alabama. Sanders planned and failed to kidnap his own children. And instead, he just reluctantly reconciled with his wife. They divorced almost 40 years later. Oh, that is just so, I love that. 40 plus years of a loveless marriage. Harlan Sanders' life would change at age 40 when he began selling food to travelers from the back room of the gas station he ran in Corbin, Kentucky. He became a hit with travelers selling his simple country fare of country ham, okra, biscuits, string beans. Damn! Country ham, okra, biscuits, string beans, and similar items as an alternative to the typical diner food found along the highways. Ironically, for some time, the only thing he didn't serve was fried chicken.
Those are stupid, y'all. Oh my God, that is so funny, y'all. They didn't even sell chicken at the damn gas station. Did y'all know Colonel Sanders didn't even sell chicken at the damn gas station? He was selling okra. Yeah. They should have called it Kentucky Fried Okra. Kentucky Fried Green Tomatoes. All right, I'll see y'all later.
Sanders would advertise the food at his Shell station by painting giant signs on barns in the area. Marketing 101. Vandalize other people's barnyard property. Agricultural surface area. This clever marketing scheme greatly upset Matt Stewart, the operator of a nearby competing Standard Oil station. Stewart began painting over Sanders' signs, so Sanders went to pay him a visit, along with two Shell district managers. What they weren't expecting was that Stewart had a gun with which he shot and killed one of the managers. Sanders, who was a known tough guy, famous for the force and variety of his swearing, naturally had his own gun and returned fire. They did a redneck shooting match over the fried chicken. He only wounded Stewart in the shoulder, but even if he didn't knock out his competition by killing him, he still got the result he wanted. Stewart went to prison for murder, and charges against Sanders were dropped, leaving him the gas station king of Kentucky. And that's the American dream. That's the American dream. You vandalize your neighbor's property, get more business than him. He comes and finds you, shoots you, kills one of your friends. You shoot him, he goes to jail. That's crazy. His chicken was so good, he got named a colonel. He is not a colonel. While it's true that Harlan Sanders did serve in the Army, he wasn't that kind of colonel. He lied about his age to join the Army in 1906 at age 15 or 16. He served in Cuba, but only... Fuck, Norton antivirus, bro! Get this shit off of my back! I guess we'll never know. We'll never know the true story of Colonel Sanders because Google wants to fuck on me. Here we go. How racist was Colonel Sanders? Let's get to the bottom of this shit. I don't trust anything from Quora. Yeah, let's go on the Wikipedia. I don't know. I was tweaking on that one website. Here we go. Okay, so he killed off his competition. Sanders was commissioned as a Kentucky colonel in 1935 by Kentucky Governor Ruby LaFoon. Now, that is the most Looney Tunes-ass name I have ever heard in my damn life. Ruby LaFoon? His local popularity grew, and in 1939, food critic Duncan Hines visited Sanders' restaurant and included it in Adventures in Good Eating, his guide to restaurants throughout the U.S. The entry read, Corbin, Kentucky, Sanders Court and Cafe, a very good place to stop en route to Cumberland Falls and the Great Smokies. Continuous 24-hour service. Sizzling steaks, fried chicken, country ham, hot biscuits. 50 cents to $1. For lunch, and for dinner, 60 cents to $1. In July 1939, Sanders acquired a motel in Asheville, North Carolina. His North Corbin restaurant and motel was destroyed in a fire in November of 1939, and he had to rebuild it. By July 1940, he was 50 years old, Sanders had finalized his secret recipe for frying chicken in a pressure fryer that cooked the chicken faster than pan frying it. As the United States entered World War II in December 1941, gas was rationed, and as the tourism dried up, Sanders was forced to close his Asheville motel and chicken restaurant. He went to work as a supervisor in Seattle until the latter part of 1942. Damn. Oh my God, he had a mistress? This man lived a life. Let me tell you something. After being recommitted, okay, here is his public image and personality. After being recommissioned as a Kentucky colonel in 1950 by Governor Lawrence Weatherby, Sanders began to dress the part, growing a goatee and wearing a black frock coat, later switching to a white suit, a string tie, and referring to himself as Colonel. His associates went along with the title change, jokingly at first and then in earnest. He never wore anything else in public during the last 20 years of his life, using a heavy wool suit in the winter and a light cotton suit in the summer. He bleached his mustache and goatee to match his white hair. John Y. Brown Jr. remembered Sanders as a brilliant man with a gourmet flair for food, a visionary, and a great motivator. He was a Freemason. Freemasons scare the shit out of me, dude. That's as close to the Illuminati being confirmed as we will ever get. And I know some people can be like, it is confirmed. Shut the fuck up. I'm not trying to talk about that with you right now. Freemasons do scare me, though. Okay? He died of leukemia in 1980. That is real sad. By the time of Sanders' death, there was an estimated 6,000 KFC outlets in 48 countries worldwide with $2 billion in sales annually. That is just crazy, truly. Like, the fact that you can go to any country on earth, arguably, and get Kentucky Fried Chicken. American Manifest Destiny is still finding its destiny. It's still finding its destiny, Hope Cyrus. Smiley Molly. Okay? You know what I think about a lot? That episode of Hannah Montana when Dolly's on the episode and she uses her pinky nail as a key. I tried to do that as a child so many times. Doesn't work. And then I realized, oh, it was a joke for a TV show. When she's like, I haven't carried keys in years. Because she uses her long acrylics to unlock stuff. Hurt myself. I was like, well, Dolly Parton can do it. Okay, back to the history of Popeyes. Popeyes UK. What are we talking about? Oh, you know, I had this thought the other day. This is a total tangent. I had this thought the other day of like, you know how there's that girl on TikTok who does the like making fun of influencer voice where she's like, hey guys, today I'm going to get my hemorrhoid cream from CVS. Like that voice, that I want to do that bit. Like if I ever did stand up, I would do that for just 30 minutes. Okay guys, I'm going to get my eczema cream from Walgreens. Now this is under my Blue Cross Blue Shield health insurance. If you cannot afford that, don't know what to tell you. I am meeting my friends there and I am wearing my glossy ain't. Like just that for 30 minutes. That's so funny. But like the most disgusting rancid shit you've ever heard.
So I'm just going to apply this to my hemorrhoid. It is black and blue today because I sat on it and squished it. Get ready with me to go get my hemorrhoid cream from CVS.
That's the bit. Just wanted to test that on you guys. Let me know if I should workshop it, okay? It's in development. I also wanted to touch on... Okay, really quickly. I know I've been saying I want to talk about Dune for the last 4 fucking weeks. Here is me actually talking about Dune. Dune ignited something in me. I'll be honest, I did not see the first one when it came out, okay? I had my Timothée Renaissance after Dune 2 that ignited it. I've gone back and watched Little Women. I'm going to watch Call Me By Your Name. And so I went back and watched Dune 1, then watched Dune 2 again in theaters. And when I say, like, obviously the discourse online has been all about, like, Star Wars and every sci-fi movie you love is based on Dune. Dune was the genesis. Dune was, it's the blueprint. It's the whatever. Yeah. Okay. That doesn't mean I can't also enjoy Star Wars. That being said, I have been warned about the evolution of the Dune plot and timeline and what ends up happening with Paul Atreides. And he has children and one of them's a half worm. I don't particularly know what follow-up questions I even have to ask right now because I'm just very confused. There's also like 9 books or something like that. I will say, I do want to read the first one before they come out with Dune 3, which I'm so excited for. So going back, watching Dune 1, everyone was like, oh, you don't need to see it. It's just world building. Okay, that's the whole fucking point of sci-fi, bro. World building. I'm locked in. So I go back and watch Dune 1. Loved it. I read all the lore, which means I watched like 13 TikToks on it. The little slideshows where they're like, here's the tea on the Harkonnens. And I'm like, right. So I'm like, I'm fully invested. I go back and watch Dune 2 again. And oh my God. I mean, just truly, I don't think they could have casted Paul better. I think that I love stories of the reluctant hero or the hero's journey of, you know, I don't want to do this, but I have to do this. And the whole joke of like, Lisa Lagaib, like he as written, like he's like, I don't want to be in power. And they're like, as written, because he doesn't want to be, because true leaders don't want to lead, but they are destined to lead. I really think that Timothy did it so well. A beautiful, he's just such a, he's one of the greatest actors of our generation. So good. And it started me down this rabbit hole of the Dune lore, of like how fucked it is that he's part Harkonnen and he's like started this holy war that, I mean, I don't, is it doomed to fail? None of the other houses came to his aid. Like, is he raging this holy war because he is, you know, the prophet? Like, he is. He drank the blue worm piss, and now he truly is, you know, and is it just a matter of convincing everyone else that he is the chosen one? Or I'm so excited for the third movie. Also, I don't know if I'm going to get through the whole book series by the time. So don't ruin shit for me, dude. I'm avoiding spoilers. I know the book's been written. Leave me alone, okay? It's fun to fantasize. It's started me down this whole rabbit hole of like sci-fi dystopian books, because for me, everyone knows, it has to be fantasy romance for me to really give a fuck about it. And I stand by that. There has to be an element of romance to it. If I'm leaving the world of fantasy and I'm entering into you know, dystopian sort of science technology based things, that's a different, I need to tap into a different part of my brain to really enjoy that. And like, because it's a lot of history there. The way that it's different with when you're reading something like ACOTAR or like Twilight, you know, where it's fantasy and it'll explain the lore, it's different than like, okay, I have to figure out how this world works. I'm reading a book right now, and I've had a bunch of others recommended to me, and it's books like that where you have to figure out, okay, what do these terms mean? What do these ships look like? It's a complete reimagination of, you know, what you have in your head as like Star Wars or Dune or any of these, you know, even Blade Runner sort of thing. Like, this is my understanding of what a dystopian, futuristic, post-apocalyptic, post-societal collapse society would look like. And so that's been a little hard for me, because the last time I really was into that was like Divergent and Hunger Games, which are great, you know, but it's different as an adult because I'm not, it's not YA anymore. So yeah, that's been fun, and I'm really loving it. And there's elements of romance in it, which I'm, of course, need. I crave it. I thrive on it. But I think after this, I need to go back to my fantasy shit, because it's a lot to go from one sci-fi world directly into another when it's like, okay, I'm needing to understand how this society is structured. Okay, thanks for listening, team. Love you guys. Go get your merch at broski.shop. And I'll see you next week. Bye.